This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. My guest today is John Ross, the great journalist who lives in Mexico City and who's been there for 25 years, knows more about that country than anyone else I know. He's written more than 10 books. His latest is El Monstruo, Dread and Redemption in Mexico City. John Ross, welcome back to Progressive Radio.
Great to be here, Matt.
Is a book not just about Mexico City, though. It's actually a history of the country and the people of Mexico.
Well, in a real sense, when you tell the story of Mexico City, you have to tell the story of the country. And all power emanates from Mexico City. All tribute during the Aztec Empire was paid to Mexico City, and pretty much that's been the model. So the story of Mexico City is the story of the country, and indeed the story of epics like the Mexican Revolution are the story of a revolution against Mexico City. So, you know, the story really does reflect the entire country. Mexico is a country named for its capital, you know, unlike other countries where, you know, Guatemala City, for example.
You know, I hadn't realized until I read this how much Zapata hated Mexico City. You kept talking about that, and that was an interesting aspect of it.
I think I had a long colloquy with my friend Jack Womack, you know, precisely about that, about Zapata's attitudes towards Mexico City. He had the ability to destroy the city because he controlled the reservoir system and he controlled the electricity system, but he didn't in the end.
He decided
he needed Mexico City in order to secure the land of his town, Nenenquilco, in the end. So, you know, but it was always his intention. He didn't want to take the city because he was afraid his army would be corrupted by Mexico City, which he viewed as a kind of Sodom and Gomorrah.
And tell us about Zapata's demise.
Well, it's the end of the Mexican Revolution. This year we are celebrating the 100th anniversary of the beginning of the Mexican Revolution in 1910. Emiliano Zapata was lured to the Hacienda Chinameca by the forces of Venustiano Carranza under the pretext of being rearmed. And, of course, it was all a trick. And rode through, as we remember that old Marlon Brando movie, rides through the gates into the hacienda, and the soldiers are on the roof, and they mow him down, and his body is taken up the Cuautla Valley and plunked down in the middle of the city of Cuautla, and people come and look at the body, and they say, well, wait, this isn't Zapata. You know, he had a scar here. He had a birthmark there, you know. And talking to old people, I lived right on the edge of the Ejido and of Nenenquilco for a number of years. You talk to the old timers, they would tell stories about how Zapata really set his body double and went down to Acapulco and got on a boat and went to Arabia and came back many years later on two canes and saw how badly the campesinos were still being treated, and so he died of a broken heart.
So his ghost is still around, kind of, though. And obviously with the Zapatistas. But what happened to the Zapatistas? What's going on with them?
Well, they're precisely where they have always been, in their enclaves in southeastern Chiapas, about 1,300 communities, five public centers, about 150,000 comuneros, people of four different Mayan ethnic groups. Basically, they have been battling for the last 16 years for autonomy, which means getting off the government grid.
And is the government leaving them alone now?
The government pretty much has ignored them. That seems the government has decided the best way to deal with the Zapatistas is just to ignore them. That's perfectly okay with the Zapatistas. They don't want anything from the Mal Gobierno. So the military incursions have slowed considerably. You don't see much troop movement in the jungle any longer. And most of the conflict is with other communities over land.
And Subcomandante Marcos, is he still with them?
Well, Subcomandante Marcos is really just the mask, you know. My sense is we haven't seen him for 14 months. And my sense is that they have decided that the subcomandante Marcos is no longer a useful persona for them. So all subcomandante Marcos has to do is remove the mask and he's somebody else, you know. But we haven't heard from him for a long time. And I think, indeed, he has kind of outlived his usefulness. The Zapatistas don't need this public spokesperson that's constantly challenging the prevailing system. They pretty much can do it for themselves now.
I'm speaking with John Ross. He is an American journalist, an old beat, actually, old member of the Beat Generation, poet, jazz guy, went down to Mexico many, many years ago and has been doing incredible reporting there ever since. His latest book is El Monstruo, Dread and Redemption in Mexico City. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of The Progressive. Tell me about your fascination with Mexico City.
Well, I arrived in Mexico City, as you mentioned, as a part of the Beat Generation. I was kind of a younger Beat. We were about, oh, I would say about 15 years younger than Jack Kerouac. I was 15 years younger than Kerouac. I knew him. Didn't get along with him very well.
What was he like?
We had certain disputes, but mainly they focused on certain female acquaintances, we might say. And I actually didn't stay in Mexico City very long during that period of time. Kerouac and was living in the building that William Burroughs had kind of handed over to him on Orizabal Street. And Ginsberg and Norlowski and the whole crowd, Gregory Corso, my old homeboy from the West Village, was there. But we went out to the country, you know, and blew up our TV and had a lot of kids and did all that. And so I was out in Michoacán for many of the years that the Beat Generation was holding forth. A couple of years ago, Lawrence Ferlinghetti was in Mexico. Translation of his book, The Mexican Night, had appeared. And Lawrence invited me to read with him at Bellas Artes and at this club that the beat writers used to read at the Club Bombay. So there's been a kind of revival of the Beat Generation. There's the whole little tour you can take of the Colonia Roma, sort of the bars the Beats inhabited and the places where they lived.
But you can, and then you write that you came back to Mexico City on assignment.
That's right. I was working for good old News Service, Pacific News Service, in the Southern Cone, actually doing very dangerous work interviewing guerrilla leaders in the Andes. It was a kind of grant we had to do that. And the Mexican earthquake occurred, the Mexico City earthquake occurs on September 19, 1985. My boss, Sandy Close, sent me back into Mexico to cover the sequel to the earthquake, because earthquakes... they changed the social dynamic in countries. You know, we had seen in Peru in 1970, the great Andean earthquake drove people down to Lima, and all the Pueblo Jovenes outside of Lima became a seedbed for Sendero Luminoso. In Nicaragua in 1972, the Somoza family absconded with all the aid, and it was really what germinated and galvanized the Sandinista movement. So we expected that kind of dynamic would take place in Mexico City, and lo and behold, it did. And people took control of their own lives because the government paid no attention to them after the earthquake and formed important organizations, forced the government to build replacement housing precisely in the neighborhoods where it came down instead of moving them to the outskirts of town. And by 1988, that had translated into a political movement, and Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas ran for the presidency, won the presidency, had it stolen from him. The PRD was founded, and actually in 1997, Cárdenas became the first elected mayor of Mexico City. And the PRD has controlled Mexico City for the last 13 years. There's no other left party that has controlled so large a city for so long a time anyplace else on the planet.
Yeah, and you called Mexico City Left City. Do other people call it Left City, or is that your name?
Well, that's my name for it, but I think we have to take into account that it really is Left City, in the sense that the left has run the city for the past 13 years. And what that has really translated into is much more citizen involvement in the way the city operates. Much more attention to the people down at the bottom. We have a city that's 80% living in and around the poverty line, maybe 17% middle class, maybe 3%. Above that, and then a very small number of very, very rich people in Mexico City. So in a real sense, paying attention to the poor which the left is supposed to do. No, it has been, I think, it probably the most important accomplishment that these four left, we call them jefes de gobierno, chiefs of government, have achieved in these past 13 years.
You have a passage in this book, El Monstruo, John Ross, where you talk about what the left needs to do when it wins cities and how leftists who become mayors lose cities. And part of it, as you were saying, is you got to attend to the interests of the majority of the people there. The left loses cities, you write, when it regards them as stepping stones to higher political power, even presidencies. Most of all, the left loses when it hoards power, isolates itself from the civil society, and refuses to share the responsibilities of governing with El Pueblo. So it's a very interesting passage in your book, El Monstruo. What is the relationship then between the city of Mexico, governed by the left, and the presidency?
It's always been a very fractious relationship. Most pronouncedly, I think, during the regime of Vicente Fox, the first opposition party candidate from the PAN to inhabit Los Pinos, the Mexican White House, and Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who was perhaps the most vociferous and enthusiastic defender of the poor people. And I remember at López Obrador's inauguration, Vicente Fox is sitting in the first row, and Andrés Manuel says that I'm going to govern the city for the poor, and he looks directly at Vicente Fox. And from that moment on, the two were put on the boxing gloves, and it didn't end for 6 years. And of course, Fox tried to prevent López Obrador from being a candidate for the presidency in 2006.
Yeah, you said López Obrador said about 12 times the poor come first.
Right.
Every time he said it.
No, it definitely
Fox
was his.
Died.
It was his slogan, and it was more than a slogan. Within months, he had provided pensions for people like myself of the Tesseri Edad, of older people. Only government workers got pensions in Mexico up until that point. Now they get 1,000 pesos a month. Single mothers, disabled people. We have unemployment insurance in Mexico City where that doesn't happen anyplace else in the country.
What is going on with López Obrador these days? What's he doing? Is he going to run for the presidency in 2012?
Well, I think the party that he represented, actually he represented a coalition of parties in 2006, has fractured pronouncedly. You know, the party is very divided. I think that we will see López Obrador continues to be very focused on electoral politics, which I think is his Achilles heel. He spent in the last 4 years traveling around the country to the most backwater places in the country, setting up organizations. So he has little groups of people in many places where no other political party is operative. And I think that is focused on a run in 2012, but he probably won't run for the Party of the Democratic Revolution. He'll probably be put forth by a coalition of left parties, and a candidate of the PRD in 2012 will be the current mayor of Mexico City, Marcelo Ebrard. And it appears that that's the direction in which we're moving at this point. But as I always say, there's a while to go here. We have a couple of years here before all this stuff works itself out. And indeed, the importance of electoral politics has been severely lacerated in Mexico. People don't have much faith in political parties or the electoral system these days.
John Ross, I want to ask you, as someone who was a citizen in the U.S., citizen of Mexico, why in Mexico, millions of people would camp out for months and months after an election was stolen. But for instance, when George W. Bush stole and the Supreme Court stole the election from Al Gore, no one did anything.
I know. It's a pronounced difference, you know.
What's your explanation for that?
We always say that the 2000 election, in 2000, the United States had a Mexican election, no, very much like. And actually, we had a U.S. election because Fox used television, negative advertising, brought in Dick Morris, James Carville was working for the PRI. So, you know, we had a U.S. election. The U.S. had this Mexican election. I think it very much is the involvement of the pueblo, of the people, in daily politics. And electoral fraud has a long history in Mexico. And we had the precedents of 1988. 2006 rolled around again. We were seeing the same thing happen. And López Obrador was tremendously popular. And so he was able to put on July 30th, 2006, 2 million people in the streets of Mexico City. You know, you don't march when you have 2 million people. You just stand there, you know, because there's no place to march. And that translated into an occupation of the city for the next month. And that kind of involvement. I saw so many people in that encampment that I knew from the days of the earthquake. People that had been living on the street in 1985 after the buildings came down and became part of the movement that changed the city, there they were again in the street. So there is that history of participation, particularly in Mexico City.
And Al Gore did not really represent the people people's movements.
Not really. And I think that the Democratic Party made a studious effort not to mobilize people. No.
And even at the Electoral College, I mean, Al Gore told Paul Wellstone not to challenge any of the votes. So, I mean, that was as demobilizing as anything else.
But, you know, George Bush was selected, not elected, as we say. Mm.
Yeah. I'm speaking with John Ross, who's the author of this history of Mexico City and Mexico itself. The book is called El Monstruo, the Monster, Dread and Redemption in Mexico City. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor at the Progressive Magazine. The book... Tell me about how you decided to put the book together, because I enjoyed it for its conversational style and also for a kind of a unique tactic you have in writing the book, in that you tell about the hotel where you've been living for 25 years, and then interspersed in the book and the history are interviews you have with people in the restaurant at the hotel.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think we're all part of history. We all have a little piece of history. And who can tell it best but the people that have lived it? And so we go to La Blanca Cafe, Cafe La Blanca in the Centro Histórico, where I always eat dinner and breakfast, and talk to the people that are sitting next to me at the counter. And they have marvelous stories to tell, and marvelous stories that reflect the history of the city, you know? And also very acute observations about what is happening politically in the city right now. One question the other day was... are we going to have a new revolution in 2010? Because it's the 100th anniversary of the Mexican Revolution, you know. And the reactions I got to that were quite interesting. My partner, Don Raimundo, crossed the counter, and I kind of said, Don Ray, are we going to have a revolution this year? And his father was a Zapatista, an hombre de trapo blanco. He just put his hands to his head, and he said, I hope not. Because the Mexican Revolution cost Mexico a whole lot. And those stories of no harvest in 1950, 1960, a pueblo that was suffering from famine, the industrial plant destroyed, all of that have come down over the years. And the truth is that Mexicans are not very much, don't look at the process of revolution as being beneficial to them. The revolution was eventually sold out. So
it's not a romantic thing.
Yeah, I think we look at it from a distance, and it seems quite romantic. We see Zapata and Villa, you know, advancing on Mexico City and all the lore that comes out of it. But, you know, for the people that lived on the ground, it's always the poor people who suffer. The people, the color of the earth, as Subcomandante Marcos calls them, they are always the ones that bear the brunt of revolutions. Mexico lost a fifth of its population in the 1910 revolution. War of Liberation from Spain, in which we're celebrating the 200th anniversary of, and again, a fifth of the population was decimated. Again, all of them, the people, the color of the earth.
John Ross, great journalist based in Mexico City. For most Americans, when they hear about Mexico these days, they think of the drug war. What's behind the drug war?
Well, again, I always kind of preface this by saying that Mexico is so much more than a drug war. And it's become an easy hook to hang stories on. It's been because of the violence it attracts. It's got that nota roja, the, you know, kind of... tint to it, and you know, people are fascinated by bloodletting and horrendous crimes and people being hung from freeways and the incredible violence that's taking place around the border. I think we have to contextualize it. This phase of the drug war is probably the fourth or fifth drug war I've been a witness to in Mexico, really begins on December 6, 2006. 6 days after Felipe Calderon is inaugurated as president. Half the country didn't believe he was president. He had little legitimacy and no authority. And he mobilized the military to go after the drug cartels. And that ostensibly would give him authority. But you can't really do this in terms of political pragmatism as a ploy to enhance your authority. And I think that sending the military into, he sent 30,000 troops into his home state of Michoacan. That's kind of escalated since then. Mexican presidents usually have one drug lord that is their go-to guy, because they can't deal with five and six cartels at once. So they want one strong man that they can negotiate with. And clearly the strong man in Mexico for the last 10 years, the Panista strong man, has been El Chapo Guzman, who escaped from maximum security prison 1 month after Vicente Fox is elected president. And I just saw a study that was done at the Technological Institute of State of Mexico. 50,000 drug war arrests since 2006, and very few of them belong to El Chapo's gang, and none of them are bigwigs in that gang. They've taken down the rival gangs, and that's the way presidents favor their one drug lord, so that they can negotiate with them. And the rumors are that the PAN, Calderon, will negotiate with El Chapo Guzman before the 2012 election to lower the level of violence that's occurring right now. But by disrupting the trade and disrupting all of the cartels, you put them against each other. There's a lot more drugs in Mexico these days because the border is militarized. The drugs don't get out of the country that fast, and so they leak out. They need to have a market. There's a ready market for it. So a lot of this stuff is really turf wars about where you can sell. It's kind of, I've been saying that Mexico has turned into an annex of that HBO show, The Wire, you know, with these drug cartels fighting on every corner for space to sell their drugs.
But the scale of violence is so great. You write that, John Ross, that 19,000 people have died since 2006.
That's the latest count, and I'm beginning to see higher figures, but people are dying every day, you know. And there has been a tremendous loss of life and tremendous degradation of life on the border. I just came up from the border. I've been traveling along it, and the horror across on the other side. El Paso, you know, by the way, is like one of the safest cities in the United States right now. And I think it's up there in the first five in safe cities, right across the river from Ciudad Juarez, no? So there's a lot of manipulation going on in terms of saying the threat to the United States and the Mexican drug dying is going to spill over into the U.S. We really don't have any evidence of that at this point. And we look at the cities along the border, it doesn't yield any evidence that would substantiate at this point. But it is a way of, well, it's a way of selling papers, but it's also a way of increasing the military establishment in Mexico through the Plan Merida. $1 billion going down the drain. It's actually subsidizing the U.S. defense industry. This money never arrives in Mexico. And now we have what Plan Merida has done is increase the intelligence capacity of the Mexican government to operate against not just the drug gangs, but against any incipient guerrilla threat or any incipient revolutionary threat in the country at the same time.
And what is the incipient revolutionary threat right now? You're right that there's some anarchist groups around, but we've talked already about the Zapatistas. They seem content to stay where they are. So where are
things? I think the Zapatistas will not be a source of uprising in 2010. 2010 is, of course, this historical platform. You know, it's an opportunity, you know, in terms of left groups, in terms of armed groups, to take action. The anarchists have moved on the patriotic holidays last year, 2009, and again on the first of the year, scores of bombings all around the country in Mexico, Mexico State, San Luis Potosí, Guadalajara, Tijuana. The coordination of the attacks is what made it really clear to me that something more was at work here. There are guerrillas in the Sierra of the state of Guerrero, traditional seat of guerrilla action. The military has faced off against them in the last year. And other pockets of resistance around the country. I think the north is where traditionally where revolution comes from in Mexico. Villa and Carranza and Madero all came from the north and moved south to take power in the south. And it's actually where the Zapatistas come from. They were originally in Monterrey and Torreon and then went south. And, you know, with the specter of the drug war on the border raises an article I put out last week, ran on Counterpunch, I think, talked about the possibility of a narco-guerrilla developing in the north of Mexico. We'll see what happens over the next couple of months. I think these are kind of crucial months ahead, but don't be surprised if you suddenly hear of armed groups rising in Mexico in the next bunch of months.
I read that article you posted, John Ross, and you had a line in there that said the option of a U.S. preventative invasion is always on the table.
Well, I think that it's always on the table. There's no question about that. And that may indeed be what is in back of the Joint Chiefs of Staff report, the Joe report, that said Mexico is a failed state. Mexico and Pakistan are potentially failed states. Well,
do you think it is a failed state?
I think that we have a failed government, but I don't think Mexico is a failed state. No, and I think you have to draw that distinction. You know, the U.S. has always had, the U.S. has invaded Mexico five times. A preventative intervention in Mexico with the drug war seems to be what the tremendous attention being paid to the drug wars and the possibility of spillover into the U.S. seems to be hinting at, seems to be getting at. So that option is always there. And Mexico will be very resistant to any kind of military action, but there's always the Blackwaters. There's always the mercenary armies that can be utilized to move into the country to deal with the drug war. The DEA, the FBI all have offices in every major provincial city in Mexico, and the U.S. is actually operating on the ground right now. Armed agents are actually operating on the ground.
Yeah, you said they were involved in taking down one of the narco traffickers recently, Homeland Security and FBI.
Well, the last two narco traffickers, the bigwigs, the big fish, as they call them, Pescordos, Beltran Leva in Cuernavaca, clearly the DEA fingered him, was able to locate him. And I was surprised that the last drug lord that was taken down, El Teo, in Baja California Sur, was apparently localized by ICE. And I had not heard until this point. I know that ICE is operating
by
in the country.
The Immigration Service of the United States.
But I hadn't realized that they, and probably what happened was that they busted somebody in some kind of border situation. They located and through that. But we had not heard that ICE was actually involved in the drug war until now. My sources on that are really good sources.
What are your sources on another agency of the U.S. government that might be involved there, the wing of the Pentagon called NORTHCOM?
Say that again?
NORTHCOM, U.S. Northern Command.
Oh, yeah.
I saw the head of U.S. Northern Command testify before Congress on C-SPAN the other day, and he was saying essentially the Mexican government is outgunned by the narco traffickers, and it's a serious concern, which goes
well,
along the lines of what you were talking
under
about.
Under the parameters of NORCOM, they indeed, Mexico is the perimeter of the U.S., southern perimeter of the U.S. Security zone that they're that they have jurisdiction over. No, so NORCOM would be the instrument for an invasion of Mexico, and we would also say wars in which the U.S. Enter are always preceded by advisors. You know? So one would assume that that's where the advisors would come from this Northern Command, which was specifically designed to protect the U.S. from outside security threats. You know? And the buildup in terms of the drug war in the U.S. would indicate that Mexico is now being considered a major security threat to the U.S. So NORCOM would be an operator in this. I think we had the North American Security and Prosperity Agreement gives NORCOM fiat to be able to operate inside the country.
Yeah, it may need a formal invitation or something, but you could expect that in a trumped-up emergency, too. Unfortunately, we're out of time. John Ross has been my guest today. He's the author of El Monstruo, Dread and Redemption in Mexico City. John Ross, it's great to see you again.
You're good to be here.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.